Hello, everybody. This is Country Music Mar, and welcome to this very special edition of Spotlight here on For the People. That beautiful voice that you just heard is from Sherry W., one of our Peeps members, and obviously, as you can tell, she is a great country music artist, and we are honored and privileged to have her here this morning. Or where, whatever time it is in your neck of the woods, it is morning here out in California. And Sherry, welcome to Spotlight.
Thank you, Marlene, and thank you for asking me to do this again.
Well, I know you have a lot of interesting and exciting stories to tell us, and we'll kind of sort of go in chronological order, although as you're going to discover, Sherry is certainly a wealth of information, and we certainly aren't going to run out of things to talk about. I had a wonderful time just spending time getting things together yesterday, and I learned a whole lot just in the 20 or 25 minutes we spent. First of all, Sherry, tell us a little bit about your early childhood and what your eye disease is and the circumstances surrounding your birth and such things like that.
Well, I was born in East Tennessee, a little small town called Newport, Tennessee, Cobb County, and its primary and biggest claim to fame is that for years, and maybe even still, it was the moonshine capital of the United States, at least. And that's really all there was to do, was make illegal whiskey. And so that's what my dad did. The circumstances of my birth were illegitimacy, basically. My mom has 5 children. We were very, very poor. She never married anybody, and she raised us all by herself. And for that, I'm very proud, but it created a really, really unstable home life for all of us. And we were very independent kids.
Were you the only one in your family who was blind?
Yes, I was. We don't know why that happened. My mom has a theory, which is hilarious. She thinks she saw a light that they were doing some sort of experimentation, but that's just mom, and she's just goofier than anything. God love her. But they don't know why. My optic nerve is not developed. I was not premature. Nobody else in my family ever has been blind or had any sort of eye difficulty.
Are you totally blind?
Yes, I am absolutely totally blind. My eyes looked normal up until my daughter was born, and she and I were playing on the floor, and she hit me with a little toy popcorn popper thing, and it scratched my retina, so now they started to look kind of weird. But when I was growing up, they didn't look bad at all, and I could almost control them until I started singing. Then I started looking like I was on drugs because I get into the song and forget what to do with my eyes, and I just didn't pay any attention to my eyes at that point.
You get all wrapped up in the music and forget, I would imagine. I can see myself doing that. So now you're a little girl, 4 or 5 years old, and it's time to go to school. Did you go to public school or a school for the blind, or what was your schooling like?
Well, I went to Tennessee School for the Blind, and one of my earliest memories of that is, it actually concerns the Dixielanders, which Danny Hollis played in. And I was 4 years old, and I went to, they call it preschool conference, and I was really, really precocious when I was 4 and have remained pretty much that way. And they paraded the Dixielanders out, you know, for special occasions, kind of like they, you know, do at school. And so they had microphones, and I had listened, you know, to WSM for years and years, well, not years because I was only 4, but, you know, all my life. My mom and I would sit up and she'd listen to the Grand Ole Opry with me, and I'd say, you know, I'm gonna go there and I'm gonna sing on the Opry. I'm gonna do it, because I knew when I was like 3 that I had a really big voice. And so they had the Dixielanders playing, and they said, you know, who wants to come and talk into our microphone? Well, I was ready. And I equated microphone with Grand Ole Opry. So I went running up there, and they said, you know, say hello to the friends and neighbors. And so I took the mic, and I said, hello, friends and neighbors, and welcome to the Grand Ole Opry. And when I went home, and I believed that I was on the Grand Ole Opry, that the microphone, the whole bit, I was for it. I didn't know any better, and I was convinced that I had done it already.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. I'm sitting here just chuckling. Oh, my goodness. I can just picture this itty-bitty girl just running up there doing that. That's really neat. So, were anybody else in your family musical?
I have a cousin who is an arranger. He's out in California. He and I were the only two. His name is Bobby Boykin, and he did the movie soundtrack for one of the Graceland, like, oh, I don't know, 1,000 Years to Graceland or 3,000 Miles to Girl Leaving. One of those Graceland, they've done so many. I'm sorry, that's McKinley who's throwing a temper tantrum in the background there. But he, yes, he is musical, and he's quite good. He does a lot of jazz things. He's a very talented man.
So when you got into school then as a regular student, did you start almost immediately becoming involved in musical activities in the school?
That's another thing. Yeah. the TSB musical program was just phenomenal. And we had this wonderful music teacher, and we'd go in every day, and we'd sit on the floor for chorus, and she'd teach us these little, you know, songs. Go to sleep, my woolly bear, I, you, and those little things, which, you know, music teachers are required to do. And so one day she said, okay, boys and girls, and I loved her dearly, and she said, we're going to take requests. What would you like to sing? And I said, well, I'd like to sing a whole lot of shaking going on, and that didn't go over really very well.
You were a bopper, weren't you? That's funny. Yeah, I know. I remember when I took voice lessons, too, they said to me, don't slide like you're singing a Western. Well, I was a country singer, you know, so what did they expect? But, and how old were you at this point?
I was six, and we sang. You know, they would parade us out because we were little and we were cute. You know, the little loud kids, which I always was, were the ones who got, you know, paraded out and shown around. So that didn't help my sense of self. I was like hot. You know, I thought I was cool even when I was 6 years old.
That's really funny. So are there any other noteworthy events in school that either influenced your career or impacted your life enough that you'd like to bring to our attention?
Well, you know, TSB is my safe place, still remains my safe place. It's changed a lot. My home life, as I said, was less than perfect, and we had nothing. And I didn't even realize we had nothing really until I went to TSB, and, you know, running water for me was a luxury. Being in my own bed was a luxury. Having five drawers that were my very, very own, and a closet, and, I mean, things that, you know, most people took for granted, to me, were just wonderful. And I was exposed to theater. I was exposed to, you know, classical music, which I love. If I listen to anything now to relax, it's usually classical music. And I don't know why that happened. It just sort of evolved into, you know, my music of relaxation choice, I guess. But I was just exposed to, and it was just a haven for me. I know some people don't feel that way, but I wanted to be there all the time. And when I graduated, I thought I would die. And I had plenty of sighted friends. It wasn't that. It was just that that's where I needed to go to feel okay.
So when you had to be home for an extended time, like over the summer, unlike a lot of us who look forward to our summer vacations, I would imagine it was kind of a traumatic period every year for you to have to go home and not be in the place where you felt safe and secure and cared about.
I was out of my mind, and it wasn't so bad when I was little, but when I got to be bigger, it helped because we moved then to Knoxville, which was a little bit bigger town, and I could call people, and I called Gordon Dykes all the time. He and I were just such good friends, and his parents were wonderful people, and they encouraged me so much in my singing because they used to take, Gordon and I would sing together a lot. And they would take us out to all these radio shows and stuff, and Buddy, they would get us up there. We would sing, I don't care if they had to bulldoze. We would go up there, and they would have us wherever we needed to be, you know, and they were wonderful to me. And they showed me, well, they showed me a lot of stuff. They showed me about, you know, what a nice thing marriage could be. And they showed me, sometimes when I didn't have money, they would give me money to take back to school. They were just really, really nice people.
Were you involved in the other activities of the school, like sports or in anything like that, cheerleading or anything like that?
Well, that's my other big claim to fame, and probably the thing I'm more proud of than even the Mercury recording contract. That's pretty sad, but I was the first totally blind cheerleader at the Tennessee School for the Blind, which scares me to death because it wasn't until 1968, and that's really sad. That, you know, and I had to fight tooth and nail. They didn't think totally blind people could be cheerleaders, and that really made me mad. That wasn't what I was going to say, but that really upset me greatly. So I said, well, the heck with this, I'm going to do it, and I did, and that's, yeah, I was pretty tickled about that. And I like to ride horses, although I don't do it now because I'm probably big as most horses, But I used to ride when I was in college, and I used to ride a jumper, just for like a couple times. I didn't really like jumping because it leans you forward really a lot, and I didn't like that much. But I did like to ride.
Well, it just sounds like you're the type of person that has always just gone for the gusto and just, it didn't sound like there were a whole lot of obstacles that you couldn't crawl over, and I admire people like that because I'm not that kind of a person, I'm afraid. But when was your first professional music debut?
My mom worked in a bar, and I decided one time, it taught me a lot of stuff, but it taught me, the first thing was that it taught me that if you want money, you can go out and get it by singing a song. And I said, heck yeah, that sounds like a plan to me. So I went, I wanted to go somewhere, and she said, well, I don't have the money. And I said, well, all right, I'll just go down to the bar, and I'll sing, and I'll play the piano, and I'll work for tips. And by dang, I did, and I got the money to buy whatever it was. I was 13. And I said, well, shoot, yeah, I'll do this again. And I did, and I kept, every time I decided I wanted to do something and she didn't have the money, I'd go sing a song, and you know, or several songs, and get it. And it taught me, you know, that you have to work, and it taught me that, you know, I could sing for money. So I guess it was a twofold lesson.
Well, that's kind of where our lives parallel, because I got my debut kind of in a similar fashion, in the respect that my folks had a restaurant, and I'd sing in there. And so I can definitely relate to that. So since you played piano, did you take piano lessons in school, or did you play totally by ear?
I did both. I took piano lessons. I started when I was, what, 8, I guess. When I first went to school, I was so little. I wore like size 4s, and my feet wouldn't reach the pedals. And even when I got big enough to reach the pedals, my feet were so, my legs were so short that the piano bench would slide back, so we had to like be really careful, and you know, I couldn't do pedals for a while because I was really, really short. But I started when I was 8, and I played by ear, but we were not encouraged to play by ear. We did it. I mean, but it was like a very contraband thing to do. And the interesting thing about that is that my music teacher and I were very, very close. She died probably 4 or 5 years ago, and I loved her absolutely to death. And one day, she and I had gone out to lunch years later after we were both grown. I mean, you know, I was grown and she was an old lady. And she said, you know, had I known that playing by ear was, because she lost her sight and became totally blind. And she said, had I known that playing by ear was such an important thing to people who couldn't see, I would have encouraged everybody to do more playing by ear. But we were not encouraged to do that at all when I was growing up.
That's interesting. Because I hear that from a lot of people. The music teachers that we had did encourage us. Of course, all of our music teachers were totally blind from birth, so I think it was kind of a different perspective on it. How did you find Braille music? Did you catch on to that easily, or was it a struggle for you?
I was mediocre at it. The weird thing is, and I don't really understand this, is I have gotten better. I taught music for a while when my daughter went to a Catholic school, and so I had to read music, and I put it away. I just didn't even try to read it much, you know, after I graduated. And when I picked it back up again, it's like, wow, this clicks right along. I can do this just fine. But, and I had to write it, too, you know, because I taught recorders, so I had to write the stuff down in Braille so that I would know what I was teaching the kids. They didn't need it, but I did. And so my husband reads, you know, the class, and he would just read me the notes, and I'd write it down. But it was easier for me after I got back into it than it was when I was doing it. But I think maybe it was a discipline thing. It's like I didn't want to be doing that. I didn't want to read music. I wanted to play by ear. And when I had a choice, I think it got easier. And I'm not sure if that's true, but that's what I think.
Yeah, I would imagine you're probably right. So then when you went to college, what did you take up in college?
Partying. What I was going to do was be a special education, and I say partying, but I really worked a lot. there again, we didn't have any money, and I figured that was the only way to get it. So I worked in a club on weekends, and I was going to be a special education teacher. And I was not going to sing. And the reason that I wasn't going to sing is because I thought all blind people sang, and I was going to do something. I don't know why I didn't stumble at the fact that a lot of blind people are special education teachers, but I was going to do something different. I didn't care what it was. I just wasn't going to sing. Because singing was easy for me, so I thought, well, shoot, I'm going to be, you know, how silly teenagers are. So I worked singing, and I worked in a vending stand, and but the special education was what I had chosen to do. I went to college for a year in Jackson, Tennessee, because, again, there were no blind people there, and I thought, this is the best way to make me, you know, I was the only blind person, so I said, I was miserable. I cried all the time, and it wasn't that I didn't have any friends, but I was so lonesome for Nashville, so lonesome for TSB, and so I said, well, I'll just come back and go to Peabody, which is what I did.
So at what point did you switch your interest back to music and actually start following that as a career?
We went to I always sang. I always, you know, when I was in college, it was I would do it more as a social thing, I think. One day we were at Lambeth, which is in Jackson. I was standing on the steps. They were doing blowing it. No. They were doing If I Had a Hammer. Well, heck, I knew If I Had a Hammer. Not only did I know If I Had a Hammer, I could sing If I Had a Hammer louder than anybody else, because we were protesting something. And I started singing it, and like everybody was like moving out of the way and stuff, and like, and so I realized, you know, my voice was really powerful. So when I went to Peabody, we went to a restaurant, well, a bar called The House, and there was a guy named Buck Fell who was playing piano. And I wanted to meet him, which later I didn't, but anyway, I wanted to meet him, and I said, well, I'll just sing a song by Dangies, because when I sing a song, people know who I am, and that's what I did. And he said, you know, you need to do this for a living. And I said, okay, I need the money. I might consider doing that. And one thing led to another, and that's kind of how it happened.
So when you switched your focus back to music, then did you totally scrap your plans to become a teacher, or did you follow the education through?
No, I was in college for another year and a half. I lived at Peabody, and I worked weekends, you know, still, in the clubs. But it got to the point, one semester I was taking like 21 hours, and we didn't have computers. It was stupid to take 21 hours, even if I hadn't been singing. I mean, that's just too many. But I needed to finish, and I, you know, said, well, I can do this, like an idiot. And we didn't have computers, which would have been, I think, just a big, big, major factor in, you know, time constraints, because I was pushed to the limit, and I wasn't going to let my job, you know, go down the tubes, because that was paying me like $75 a night. So I let, you know, some classes slide, which is kind of a nutty thing to do. But I haven't ever, but I finished, had one semester to go. And I just said, you know, I'm not going to use this. I'm not going to do anything with this. And I might as well just let it go and just stop and go full-time into singing, which is what I did.
Do you have any regrets that you didn't finish?
Absolutely none. Our business is doing very well. I was able to go ahead and teach anyway. And for 8 years, I didn't teach school for the blind, but I taught in a Catholic private school, taught music. So no, I've been able to do everything that I, you know, I wasn't able to become a star, but I think that was more my choice than anything else. And I could be wrong. I could be deluding myself entirely. My husband is convinced that it was my choice rather than anybody else. So I don't.
So tell me about your husband, how you met him, and all those kinds of things.
Okay. Well, that gets a little seedy, but I will do the best I can to keep it. I was working at a bar. There's a strip here in town called Lower Broadway, and there are lots of bars down there. There's Tootsie's Orchid Lounge, and the Demon's Den used to be there, and Merchants, and the Wheel. It's just a really fun, and but I went there at the last resort. I thought I was really skid rowing it, because I'd worked all these other places, and one night somebody called me and said, you know, why don't you come down to Lower Broadway, and you can work, and, you know, and I thought, oh, God, I don't want to do this, but I did. And I went to work in this bar called The Wheel, and the neat thing about it, though, and I thought, this is just the coolest thing, because you could, on your break, you could walk out of your bar that you were working, and just bop down the street, and there were all these people singing just everywhere. They still do it, except now I would not walk if somebody paid me to by myself. But then I was so dang tenacious, and I went and zipping down, and Sonny was at a bar called The Demon's Den. And he, at that time, he was a bartender, and he had the neatest voice. And I said, whoa, I kind of like him. So about 3 weeks, and he would come up to hear me sing, and because everybody, you know, there again, I was the loudest one on the street, and they had speakers outside, and you could hear people, you know, when you walked by the bar. And so that kind of, you know, drove people into your place of whatever, where you were working. So he would come to hear me sing, I'd come to hear him sing, and about 3 weeks later, I got kind of drunk, and I went down to his place, and I said, you know, we're going out right now, because I'm going to do something, I mean, I said it, but anyway, my mom was right behind me, because she worked there, and she said, well, if you're going to do it, you better hurry up, because I'm taking your butt home, only she didn't say butt. And so you better make it quick. And so then he knew that I was interested in him, and he was interested in me too, obviously. So, and we've been married 28 years.
That's kind of funny. You know, it's interesting to me. A person, I don't know whether it's a stigma or whether I'm extremely sheltered or what, probably a little bit of both, but a person doesn't necessarily picture a blind person in that surrounding and totally immersed in that side of life. I think a lot of us have been very sheltered and protected from that, although, you know, I did play in clubs and things like that, and witnessed a few fights and things like that. Did you ever witness anything like that, where you felt threatened in any way when you were performing, where people got a little rowdy on you?
Oh, that's a funny story, too. My mom, there are two stories, but I'll tell you this one. We had our own bar one time, and my mom, God love her, is the queen of queens. She will move stuff around on you in a heartbeat. My God, I hate it. So she had been there cleaning the bar. She was working and just cleaning the bar up for us. And Sonny and I lived above the bar. My husband, Sonny, used to wear this hat, and he still has it, and it has a little hat band in it. And he put silver dollars all around the hat to kind of, you know, make it, was like a garish thing to do, sort of like the Porter Wagner type stance, only we grew up sort of in the outlaw phase, so he was looking kind of cool and stuff. And he kept it on the PA set behind the bar. And so this guy came in, and he was going to mess with Sonny's hat. And Sonny said, bud, you better leave it alone. And he kept, you know, messing with the PA and messing with the hat. And he got really, really kind of nasty and mean. And Sonny said, Sherry, call the police. Well, I was behind the bar. I was behind the bar, and I started looking for the phone. And my mom was there. She's going, to your left, to your right. No, no, not there. Over there, to your left. And I'm going, damn it, Mom, why in the heck can't you leave stuff where we put it?
Oh, that's so frustrating. I hate it when people do that, too. So, did you eventually have to call the police, or was there any further trouble or anything like that?
No, he left after we, you know, after we, he really thought we were going to call the police. The other funny one about Mom is one night we were at the Wheel, and the stage was at the back of the club, and I was up on stage, and my mother talked probably louder than I do and a lot more country. And so this guy had a gun, and he pulled out a gun, and Hazel was running back to get me, and she's going, now you just wait just a minute, that's my youngin' up there, now you just get your butt, she didn't say butt, away from her right now and let me through so I can get my youngin' off that stage. It was kind of embarrassing. No, I did not feel threatened, but Mom was absolutely like a mama lion.
Oh, God. gosh. Oh, that's funny. Oh my goodness. Yeah, I've never had anybody pull a gun, but I always was a little afraid of that. So is your husband fully sighted, or does he have a sight problem as well?
He is fully sighted. He has a thing called macular retinal degeneration, which we thought was going to get worse, and they told us that it would, but so far, and he's 61, I think, 61, it hasn't. He's had it now for about, 30 years. They at first thought he had retinitis pigmentosa, but obviously that wasn't true. And so, yes, he's fully sighted, and we have all the sighted paraphernalia, but he is really cool. He's very, he doesn't think that there should be a computer in the house that Joe is my son-in-law, who's blind, cannot use. So we have JAWS on all of our computers, and we won't have one without it.
That's really neat that he's sensitive to that and understands it. And so how many children do you have?
Together we have one named Ashley. She's 22. He has two other daughters who live, one of them was living here, and she just moved away to Iowa, Greta and Yolanda. And Ashley has McKinley, who is the devil child. I figured by now she'd be in here talking, but she lives with us, and she's just a joy to us all.
That's interesting. You said that you own your own business. How long did you have that?
We have a vending business. Well, we had a bar before that. When I signed with Mercury, we had a bar down, actually two doors down from Tootsie's. It's now Jack's Barbecue. If anybody's ever been to Nashville recently, that's what it is, on Lower Broadway. That used to be where we worked and lived, right above there. There's a big pig now on the door. But it was called the Crosswinds Lounge, and we had that for about a year and a half maybe. And then we signed with Mercury and went on the road, and I came back here, and I just decided that I wanted a little more control than we had, because we did fine as long as we were on the road. We would make, I don't know, $1,000 a night, $1,500 a night, and we had a duo, so we were doing okay. But when we came home, when we came back to Nashville, we did very poorly, and we were lucky to get $50 a night. So I said, I want to be able to live here and not go without a major label and not travel all the time. And so I went to, it just made me feel there again. I needed to feel safe, and I didn't feel safe. I don't know why I didn't, but I just didn't feel right about continuing to be on the road all the time. So we came back here, and I went to our training class for vending school, and I've been a vendor now since 1979. And I guess we have one of the better stands in the state. I know that it does, well enough to certainly want to keep it.
Where is your stand located?
Well, it's not actually a stand. It's actually a go. We have we have a jail. It's a correctional work center, and we deliver twice a week in sealed units. And we have vending machines that are located in a mental hospital, drug treatment center, and some other, a RIP thing, which is another juvenile offenders.
So tell me about how you wound up getting signed with Mercury and what that experience was like.
We had a friend who was working at a college. He was a student, and it was so neat when we hired Barb because, it was on 4th and Broad, and everybody used to come in there. We had steel guitar players that were just lined up practically. I hated it when that would happen, but they would be lined up to the door. Buddy Emmons and Jimmy Day and Julian Thorpe, and I mean just people that, that I didn't care if I knew, but they would come into the bar. And one of the people was named Gary Laney, and he wasn't famous, but he was a student at Belmont, and he said, why don't you come and cut a demo session, and I'll, give you the studio time. All you have to do is buy the tape. And so I said, okay, we'll do it. And we went and spent $60, bought one of those, I don't know if you've ever seen them, but the tapes are like about 6 inches tall. They're really, really big. And not really, but they're huge. And they fit on these humongous, they weigh about 3 pounds. If you drop one on your toe, you want to die. And so we bought one of those and did 6 songs. And took it around to different labels, and we took it around to RCA Victor, and they were interested. They would have signed me, and we took it to Playboy, and even they would have, and that was weird because I wasn't, you know, never have been a real cute, I like to say I'm not pretty, I'm just pert. I don't even care about being pretty. But they were going to sign me, and then there was another, there were 3 or 4 other labels, and I picked Mercury, and the primary reason that I did was because, first of all, there were many people then who were stars. Jerry Lee Lewis was on, and he was, you know, not a big star. Skeeter Davis was on it, and she was as cute as she can be, but she wasn't a big star either. And Reba had just signed about 3 months before me, and nobody ever heard of her. And so I thought, you know, this will be the one where I will get the most attention the fastest. And so I chose Mercury, and we signed with him, and when we did, there was a guy doing an article, and the movie, I don't know if you know about Sybil, but it's about a lady who has multiple personality disorder, and I was really excited to see it. And so they came to the bar, and they signed the Mercury thing, we signed the contract, and I said, now I'm going to go upstairs and eat my chef salad and watch Sybil, and Harris was doing the article, and he said, I've never in my life seen anybody who signed a recording contract, and instead of wanting to celebrate, you want to go upstairs, eat a chef salad, and watch Sybil. He was just really, really disappointed that I didn't get any more excited than that.
That's funny. Yes, I do remember that movie. I sure do. So after you signed with the record company, at what point did you kind of decide that you maybe didn't want to take that path? Were things progressing for you, or what kind of made you decide to just sort of pull back and do the home thing?
I started, when we came back to Nashville, we went to Missouri for a while and worked on the road, and we traveled and traveled and traveled, and I just decided I wanted to come home. And there were 2 things that happened. We couldn't make the money that I wanted to make. That was the first thing. I mean, we could have, but we would have had to have worked. We worked 7 days a week here, singing. 7 days a week, 7 nights a week, and 3 afternoons a week, just to make the money that we needed in order to, I mean, we were working all the time. And I just got really stressed out about it. You know, we had to work constantly, and I don't even know what happened. I got to where I would almost have panic attacks, and it wasn't because I was nervous or shy. It was just that I could not imagine going through the rest of my life not having some kind of night time where I could just sit back and, you know, watch television. And when I got into vending school and discovered, you know, that was when Dallas was on, I thought, God, I am so glad that it was so silly. But TV just took a whole new meaning on for me. And I was just totally delighted that I didn't have to sing every night.
Huh. That's really interesting. So you never really had all of the excitement and all the aspirations that a lot of people, you know, that get involved with that scene did, where you just wanted to keep forging ahead and all that kind of thing. It sounded to me like it was more like a drudgery. The other thing that I noticed is kind of a common thread in all the experiences that you told me, where you wandered away from home for a while, that being away from home was very uncomfortable for you, and that your heart has always been and always will be in Nashville.
Yeah, I remember when I would go visiting, and I would ride back on the bus, because I knew downtown like the back of my hand when I was a kid. I could just get on the bus and walk anywhere. And I'd get on the Greyhound bus to come back home. And as soon as he started, you know, back into the city limits of Nashville, I would just get this welcoming feeling. I don't really exactly understand it. And I was so excited to be back home, and everything was so familiar in the streets. And, you know, then it was safe. And you could walk everywhere. And I did. And I used to, when I met Ronnie Millsap at the King of the Road, he was working, excuse me. And I said, you know, let's just get on the bus and we'll get lost. I said, it's so much fun, and you know, and he's not, I don't think I want to do that. I really don't think that sounds like a lot of fun to me. But I thought he really missed out because he wouldn't come play with me, you know, on the bus and get lost.
Now, that's kind of interesting to me that he wasn't into that. I can relate to that because I'm kind of the same way. I'm not so adventuresome, although I am if I have somebody with me but not by myself.
Well, I probably shouldn't have been because it's gotten me into some really, you know, tight spots, but I'm more certainly cautious than I used to be. We had a guy that when we had we didn't have our bar actually, then we were working for a friend of ours down on 4th and Broadway, and we stepped out of the bar, and we were talking to this guy, and we turned, I don't know if anybody's ever been to Nashville, but there's an alley that goes down by, was a restaurant called Lon Ball's Restaurant, and we turned down in the alley by the Ernest Tubb Record Shop to go to our car, because it was parked a block away, and the alley was the quicker way to go. So we were going through the alley, and all of a sudden we heard these gunshots. And Daryl, the guy that we were talking to, was shot and killed right there on 4th and Broad. That might have had something to do with the fact that I, you know, became more cautious. I think partly it was because he was agitating the people, but still, you know, it's pretty scary when you think that we could have been there standing because we had talked about going to breakfast and just opted not to. And I really, because we were reading a book, we want to get home and finish our book, and we opted not to go to breakfast with Daryl. Otherwise, we'd have been standing there probably and, you know, might have been hurt along with him. So you just never know what, you know, what anybody has in store for you. And I was ready to just be safer.
Oh, yeah, that could kind of change your mind a little bit, very definitely. Well, we're coming down to the end of the hour, but are there any other things? Oh, I know one thing I was going to ask you, too. You were talking about your independent travel skills and that kind of thing. It always interested me because I wasn't given mobility lessons until I was 12 years old. And at what stage did you start learning independent travel?
Even later than that. We didn't get it till I was like in the ninth grade, so I'd have been about 14, and that's a sad thing, I think. Kids should have, and now they do, from the time they're, you know, tiny, 5, 6. We had a guy named Gary Coker who came to our school, and he was an O&M guy, specialist, and he was the very first one, and it was very, very late in the 60s. And one of the neatest things that, you know, I ever did, I remember bringing my cane home for the weekend, and it was almost like bringing your car home. You know, I was ready to go, and I did. Once I got that cane home, buddy, I was out the door and on the bus, and it was all over. And my mom never tried to stop me. She never got excited. You know, I was always very free to go anywhere I wanted to, and I think it was just because she didn't want to fool with me, but I didn't care. At least I got to go, and she didn't get in my way, and that was what she needed to do to make, you know, me as independent as I could be.
Were there ever any issues associated with your blindness where you felt uncertain? You seem so incredibly sure of yourself, and I just, like I said, I admire that so much. But were there ever any areas where you felt uncertain?
Oh, yeah, of course there, and there still are. You know, I mean, it's a daily, but one of my favorite stories, it's weird how when you said you were going to do this interview, and I started thinking about stuff. We had a beta club, which is where, you know, the high academic kids would go, and they would have a convention and do all these, you know, fun things, and we were at convention one year at a hotel, and I liked it. We grew up in the 60s, you know, where all these really encounter groups were popular, and so I like to drag everybody out and make them talk. I still do, but make them talk about things that they wouldn't normally talk about. And we were sitting around the hotel room, and I was talking to, I don't know, Jerry Kidd was there and Gordy and a bunch of us, and I said, now, guys, you know, can you realistically, because at the time I'd never dated a blind guy. And I said, I never dated a sighted guy either because I was probably 14 or 15, I don't know. But anyway, I said, can you realistically see that if there were a blind person, a blind girl in the room and a sighted girl in the room, you know, if I were in the room with a sighted girl, the sighted guy would pick the sighted girl every time. And Jerry Kidd said, well, Sherry, I don't blame him. I wouldn't have you either.
That sounds like Jerry, doesn't it? Oh, that's great. I can see that old boy hasn't changed much. So he went to school with you then?
Oh, yeah. And that was one of his more serious discussions. That's the heck of it. That was when I had him pinned down. You know, we were really talking about some nitty-gritty serious stuff, and that's about as serious as he got. But, yeah, he was a good friend, and he's very talented also. He's very bright and funny. And, yeah, we had a good group, and that's one of the things. I think that's one of the reasons that we're all so confident, and not competent, but confident. And we just all sort of stuck together and helped each other. And maybe I'm deluded about that too, but that's how at least that it was for me.
Okay, so just kind of briefly moving along then, because this is an interview for the people, how did you become interested in For the People, and what was your first exposure to the website?
The first time I heard about it, I was on the phone to my friend Randy Rusick, and he called Dennis for some reason, and I heard Dennis in the background yelling, "Have you got her on For the People? Have you got her on For the People?" And Randy said, "No." So then Larry Fain and I were talking, and he said, you know, I should try it, and I'm always so tentative, because every time it seems that I put something new on the computer, you have to change about 46 other things, and it's like, guys, I don't know if this is going to be worth it or not, and I do this every single, still do it. And so I got on here, and I was just, I told Jennifer, it's one of the neatest gifts that anybody, I mean, they're just weird gifts that you get every day, you know, and I get a lot of them. And one of them is, MSN. Somebody showed me how to do that, and just little silly things, and you're just knocked out with just, you know, and it's, I think For the People is just the neatest gift in the world that we can all just sit here, because if you're blind, it's like having somebody in your living room. You don't need to see them, so it's just like we know all these people, even though we really don't.
Well, I can definitely relate. I mean, there's several people on here that I feel like I know really well, because we don't need all the eye contact things and stuff like that. And hearing people's voices just adds a whole new dimension to it, rather than just voice chatting or emailing.
Oh, no doubt. And sometimes when I type MSN messages and I read them back, it's like, what in the heck was I trying to say? Yeah, my fingers do not always do what my mind tells them to.
Okay, so before we play our last song, first of all, I am going to open it up to some questions so that the questions from people actually get into the interview itself. But is there anything else that you would like to talk about before we open it up for questions?
No, I'll just say that first song was written by my husband. I write as well. I can't remember if I sent you anything that I wrote, but I think I did. But that was one of his songs. I'm not surprised you played it, because that was the most traditional country song that I could find. That he writes more traditional stuff than I do, and he's an excellent writer. He's a very, very talented writer, and he wrote that From My Head Down to My Heart song.
You tell that boy that he's got good taste. That was my favorite of the ones that you sent Becky, and of course, being the traditionalist that I am, that's one of the songs I had to choose.
See, I like the new stuff because it makes my voice work harder. I'm afraid that my voice is going to get, you know, old like the rest of me. And so far, thank God, it hadn't. The rest of me might be falling apart daily, but my voice seems to be holding up. But the new stuff, you really have to work hard to sing it, and I like that.
Well, the only thing that frightens me about the new music, and I don't want to get into this too much, but is that so many people are having to have throat surgery, and I'm just wondering if it's pushing people's voices too hard.
Well, you may very well have a point, and that's probably going to be, I'll probably have to add that to my list of stuff that I'm going to have done in 5 or 6 years. I'll just go in for an overhaul and get the whole works.
Okay, well, I think we'll open it to questions from everybody here, and I'm sure that a lot of people have gathered to hear this entertaining story of Sherry's life. But any questions for Sherry?
Sherry, I heard you say you had met Ronnie Millsap. I was wondering what other country singers you've met, and if you've had an opportunity to actually sing with them.
Yeah, I have. Well, of course, I've worked with Reba because she and I were on the same label. Tom T. Hall was on my label, and he did the shows with us every now and again. Like, we did a Mercury show. We never worked together, and he I think maybe came into the bar, but I'm not sure about that because his band used to come in all the time, and I'm not sure if T ever came in with them or not. I have several friends even still that are, and I've never been a singer person. I'm a songwriter person, I guess. And if I get really impressed by somebody, it's not always that they're a good singer, but I love songwriters, and so I have lots of friends. Bobby Fischer, who wrote Goodbye Says It All, and Eli is a friend. Actually, he's more of a friend of my husband's. Don Wayne, who wrote Country Bumpkin, and It's Time to Pay the Fiddler, is a friend of ours. Eater was on our label. And I actually got drunk with Jerry Lee Lewis, and we partied really, I guess, hard, but I don't really remember that very well. That was one of the things that I did that I just don't remember. But and we never sang. Well, actually, they told me maybe we did sing together. I'm not real sure about that whole deal, but I never did that but once because Jerry Lee is a very big partier, and I wasn't able to party as well as he did. But he was on our label. We had all kinds of people that, and I'm also a musician. Like Buddy Emmons came into our bar. He wouldn't probably know who he is, but yeah. So we've kind of June Carter. I never did meet. Well, Johnny Cash flew in the same plane with us, but we didn't meet him actually. So yeah, you run into people. Harlan Howard, we used to go to his house for, he had a party every year. He's a songwriter. And we'd go to his house, and Willie Nelson was there, and we would have breakfast with Willie because he wasn't very famous at all then, and we would just all go sit and have breakfast at the Pancake Pantry, which is Pancake Man, sorry, which is a little restaurant here. So, yeah, there were quite a few people when we were younger that we, Shel Silverstein, who was a sweetheart. He was a rotten, rotten man, but he was a dear, dear man.
Hello, Sherry. This is Rick. I imagine it's a challenge to memorize all these songs. And I was curious how many songs you know, how you commit them to memory, and how do you decide what songs are going to be part of your repertoire?
You know what? I don't know very many anymore. I used to, when we were playing in the bar, it was weird. First of all, I used to do sound-alike sessions. You know, it's the thing where you would go into a truck stop and you buy these records. I don't know if they still do them, but and they used to put these people on there, and they wouldn't pay them very much, and you wouldn't pay very much for the record, and you'd do Let Me Be There, which is an old song, and I don't know, just different songs. But I did that because they would pay you like $50 a song, and I was really, really quick at it. I mean, I could learn a song in 10 or 15 minutes. I could learn a song, if somebody wanted to hear it, I could learn it on our break. I'd say, play it on the jukebox, and they could play it twice, and I would go back on stage and do it. But now it's just ridiculous. I have to work sometimes 30, 45 minutes. When we were with Mercury, Sonny used to get really agitated with me because I would wait till the night before when we were going in the studio to learn the songs, and he'd say, don't you feel nervous? And I said, heck no, and I never did. But now I have to work really hard. As far as the repertoire question, if it has lots of high stuff and lots of low stuff, and if it's really loud or really soft and has lots of feeling in it, I try to put it in there. Or if it's one of the songs that says, I'm going to kick your butt all the way to China, I like that too.
I can definitely relate as far as the memorization things, because I was kind of the same way, but now I find I have to work a lot harder, and I also find that a lot of the songs that I used to know when I was younger, I don't know anymore.
Yeah, me too. It's sad. It really is. And sometimes I can dream about them and they won't even come to me in my dreams, and I'll be standing there dreaming, you know, that I'm singing a certain song and I forget the words, and it's just the most panicky feeling in the world.
Well, this is your last chance to ask Sherry a question, and we'll take one more question and then we'll play our closing song. Okay, well, if no one has any questions, Becky, what is the name of the song that we're going to play? And when she reveals the name, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about the background of the song before we play it.
The one you picked was Cry.
Okay. I'd never heard of that before, and that's why I was kind of curious, Sherry. How did you come by this song?
I saw it's a Faith Hill song, and I saw her on, and I'm not a fan of hers at all. I do not think. She's cute, and I'm sure she's very nice, but she, to me, is just not much of a singer. And I saw her on television, and I said, Ashley, is she sick? Because she just sounded so like it wasn't, you know, the song just didn't seem to be made for her, but it was a neat song. And I said, I can sing the song. I like it a lot. It's not, the timing is weird in it, and it's a song, you know, that I have to work to do. So I got the karaoke of it, and I had to lower it down a half step. The reason it was too high for me, had to lower it down a half step, and it's one of those songs that says, you know, I'd like to kick your butt all the way to China. So that's one of the reasons I chose it.
All right. Well, Sherry, thank you so much for joining us here. And this was a whole lot of fun. And I know there's a lot of your life that we didn't cover just due to time constraints, but it was an honor and a privilege for me to interview you.
Well, I thank you for asking me to do it. This is the second one I've done, and I really, really appreciate it. The reason you didn't cover probably most of my life is because I get involved and I'm very, very disorganized, and so I just like to talk. So I'm sorry if I was too jabby, but I appreciate you asking me to do it.
Well, that's, I think, what makes an interview spontaneous and fun. And I try to work under a little bit of a chronological framework, but basically I like to have people just be themselves, and you're certainly good at that. Becky, let's hear the song.
If I had just one tear rolling down your cheek, maybe I could cope, maybe I'd get some sleep if I had just one moment at your expense. Maybe all my misery would be well spent. Yeah. And you cry a little, die just a little, pretend that you're feeling a little more pain. I gave now morning something in return. So cry a little for me. If your love could be caged, honey, I would hold the key and conceal it underneath. Paralyze your head and knees, and you'd hunt those lies. Maybe all you'd ever find, that'd be all you have to go.
Great job, ladies. Thank you very much, Sherry.
Marvelous and wonderful job from you too, Mar. Thank you both.
Oh, thank y'all. Thank you for asking me to do it again.
Hey, man, you do have a powerful voice, girl. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, this was really fun. I enjoyed it immensely.
Yeah, I'm really excited to do that song in the studio because we just did that on the back porch. So I'm really kind of excited. I'm going to do it here in the studio, and they're going to actually, you know, use limiters and stuff. And that was just with, you know, homemade, but it wasn't bad. But I can't wait to see what they do with it in the actual studio.
So are you going to be putting together a CD that will be available?
Well, we're going to go down and do one. I've won some free studio time there again because I sing louder than anybody else. And, yeah, we're going to go down and do one. I'm not sure what I'm going to do with it. I just want to have it so that, you know, McKinley can have it when I'm old and she wonders what I sounded like, I guess.
Well, if you broadcast that information too much around here, I'm sure you'll have folks clamoring for it. So you might have to make provisions to at least do enough copies so that us For the People folks can be privileged to own it.
Oh, well, I'll be glad to give anybody a copy. I have 14 things now, and anybody, you know, I'm pretty willing to give anybody anything that they want. And then, you know, not many people care to have those, and it's just a pain, you know, to get them sent out. But, yeah, I don't mind, you know, giving anybody anything like that.
That's a nice thing about being able to transfer the MP3 files, too, is that it's a whole lot less work than packaging CDs up and sending them out.
Isn't that the truth? I just learned how to make CD audios into MP3s a couple weeks ago, and I have been sending, man, like a mad bat out. I love doing it. So, yeah, it's just a lot easier.
Well, there's an awful lot of people in here, and I'd like to thank all of you for coming and listening to this. And, boy, the time just flew. I couldn't believe it. All of a sudden, I looked at my watch, and it was like quarter after, and I'm thinking, where in the world did the time go?
Ooh, well, I'm in an alt tab. I thought we were all alone in here. I didn't, because I had to get out of the window. I hate this.
You know, it's always thanks to Becky for a great job of coordinating and Dennis for recording and editing. Good job done by all.
Absolutely, yes. And Becky does such a nice job of getting all these things lined up, and the connection was so good. I don't think there was a bit of breakup.
And it's been lousy all day, just about up until this show.